Okay, so really lovely to see you all. Really, really good. It's like being at Sibford again, isn't it? Except we weren't at Sibford. Never mind. I'll go on for about 5 years, probably. Okay, so what we're going to do, what I want to do now is say a little bit about this seminar. Sibad Mati was calling it a prologue, and that we'll have to do. It's a kind of before the party. So I want to talk about spiritual receptivity. That's our theme for the seminar. So I want to do two things really. Just say where spiritual receptivity fits into the sort of schema of spiritual life, the stages of spiritual life. And then I want to say something about the actual subjects we'll cover. Jim, I wonder whether you could put the extract on rather than the bottom one on rather than the top one. I think it gets very cold when that blows in. Yeah. Okay. And then after that, by the way, we'll do a puja, a short puja and a mantra, and we'll have to work out how we're going to do that without treading on each other. We'll find a way. So, yeah, the seminar, we want to focus on spiritual receptivity. And I want to just say about what that means. And then next week we'll start the seminar proper. So, in spiritual life, spiritual life is primarily a path. It's a journey from where you are now to enlightenment. So the reason we have a figure of the Buddha on the shrine is the Buddha figure represents, as it were, the goal. Even that's a bit tricky because, and we won't go to that, but let's just think that the Buddha represents the direction, like the North Star of spiritual life. He represents the direction that we're travelling in. You could say human life itself is a journey. You could say even that the metaphor of the journey is one of our primary human metaphors. Every day can seem like a journey from sunrise to sunset. Our life itself feels like a journey, doesn't it? From birth to youth to old age to death. So many things in art are to do with journeys, poems, novels, plays. Almost everything consists in a journey. So it's not surprising that the Dharma life is the sort of journey of human life. It's not a different journey to that. It's that journey lived in its fullest, in its deepest, in its highest way. I'm trying to gradually get rid of this word spiritual because I think it sounds so airy-fairy. I don't think we know any more what it means. It's become a kind of a word that we use and bandy around, but we don't really know what it means. So I want to call it just life, never mind spiritual life, let's just have life. Life is already a journey, but for us, for most of us, for all of us probably, it's a bit chaotic, that journey. It's sometimes we don't even know where we're going anywhere, sometimes we go backwards instead of forwards and so on. So what we call spiritual life, what I'd rather call Dharma life, is that journey exemplified. It's what our journey of life really means. It's what we meant by our journey, if you see what I mean. I remember when I was at school, looking up to the sixth formers in my school, they used to wear suits. And I thought, when I'm sixth former, I'll be really mature. I won't have these horrible emotions that I don't understand. I won't spill food down my jacket. I'll be like really organised. I won't be late. I won't get rice pudding on my tie and all that kind of stuff. None of which came to pass. But in a way, that used to mean that, I don't know whether you had that sense when you were young, when I'm grown up, I'll be able to do all these things. Actually, the only thing you get to do is you do what you like. And nobody can tell you not to anymore. That's about the only benefit, I think, to growing up. But there's this sense that there is such a thing of human maturity, isn't there? And that you want it. And it, already in your life it's got a certain kind of characteristics. It feels grown up in the fullest sense. It feels like somebody who has grown up will have been leading their own life. They won't be battered around by feelings and emotions. They'll be able to stick at things. They won't try the guitar one day and only give it up to do ice skating the next. They won't be trying on different clothes. I remember when I was young, I was constantly trying to find my style. What did I want to look like? I still haven't managed to find it. Do you remember that, trying out different versions of yourself? Am I this kind of person or that kind of person? And I thought that when I was mature, I'd all that be sorted out, and my signature would be a flourish, calm and yet assured. You know what I mean? And then, of course, somewhere projected behind that is, in old age, I'll be surrounded by loved ones, and I'll be some good to people. I'll be wise. Yeah? Do you see what I mean? That vision of life, I think, is intrinsic to human life. When I grow up, and then after I've grown up, I'll become responsible, and by the time I die, I'll be much loved and wise, and people will come to me. I recently, just as a quick digression, let's not do it too long, I was in Birmingham just after the retreat, and I was being interviewed for their sub-35 group. And I was trying to tell them, possibly not very cheerily, that you don't realise when you're young how much you're living on your charm. How much charm youth has. Oscar Wilde famously said that youth is wasted on the young. Which is brilliantly clever, isn't it, and very true. But you have this sort of charm. And people forgive you lots of things when you're young. You know, you can be, frankly, a pain. But because you're young, old people often are rather indulgent and forgiving, a bit like people are of little lambs. I mean, they're so pretty, and they bounce along a lot, but you sort of don't mind. And I think when you're young, you have this kind of charm. But what happens is, as you get older, that charm wears thinner and thinner. I speak as one who knows. And what happens is your basic habits and tendencies show up much, much more. Your basic mental habits become much clearer as the charm of youth and beauty sort of rubs away. You are just the person you are as you get older. By the time you're old, you have no charm, pretty much. In fact, people often don't even notice you. They get irritated with you very easily. I remember my little niece, when my mother visited, she said, "I don't like old people." And then she looked at my mother and thought, "I wonder whether I should have said that." She said, "Especially old men." Had an instinct to get around it. But you see what I mean? As you get older, your charm sort of, that you don't even quite often realise you had. Often young people don't realise the power they have, for instance. That sort of rubs away, and you're just left with the person you are. And are you going to work on that or not? Are you going to tackle that or not? Are you going to really grow up or not? Because you can't hide behind charm as you get older. There comes a point where you can feel that now I need to actually grow up. I can't do all those crazy, funny things and get away with it anymore. And when you're old, Oscar Wilde famously said, everyone ends up with the face they deserve. Which is his usual sort of, bit nippy. But it's exactly right, isn't it? That you end up with the face you deserve. In other words, you end up with the face that expresses the person you are. And I've known old people who end up being, well, it's very easy to end up angry, self-righteous, self-preoccupied, always feeling that the young don't understand you, and so on. And I've also known old people who are wonderful. I remember this friend of mine, she was dying, and she was the mother of a good friend of mine, and I went to visit her, and I felt I got more from being with her than she did from being with me. There was something quite beautiful about her. But her beauty was a moral beauty at that point. But it was very, very beautiful, and actually very attractive. You wanted to be with her. When I was a nurse, it was very noticeable. Some old people, you nurses would gravitate towards, some you would gravitate away from. So what you're left with at your deathbed is your moral beauty. Your youth, your charm, your beauty has been rubbed away, but a long time by then. And what you'll be left with is the kind of atmosphere of moral beauty that you have. And that can be extremely beautiful and very, very much valued. It can be a sort of blessing. And I think that's what we want. That's what, as we grow up, we want, to end up with that kind of moral beauty, that sort of kindness. This friend of mine, she sort of created this atmosphere around her. She was in great pain as well. So it wasn't to do with health. She was in great pain. She was dying of cancer. And she'd been in a lot of pain for a lot of her life. And yet it was a privilege to be with her. It was a kind of lesson to be with her. You felt that she had much more than I had. And I think that's what we want. I think that's what this journey of ours wants to be, doesn't it? That's what we yearn for. So that the journey of spiritual life is that journey exemplified, so that you end up in the Parinirvana as a Buddha, not just as a wise man or woman, but you end up with something of inestimable worth. So if you think of that journey, what we need to do first of all is mature. And maturing mainly means becoming more and more collected, more and more responsible, more and more able to act out of self-awareness, less thrown around by things. You know, the sort of sixth-former sense that we hope to be, more and more gathered together, more and more able to decide to do something and see it through, more dependable, all those sorts of things. And the word that Sangharakshita has used to describe that is integration, where you're more dependable, more clearly you're a moral agent. You live your own life from your own side. You're not one person one moment and another the next. You're not a one person with one friend and another with the next. It's always interesting when you have a birthday party, can you bear having all your friends together? Because you're a slightly different person for each one of them. So growing up, first of all, means becoming the same person, publicly and privately, for this friend over here, for that friend over there. So you're just one person who lives their own life. And then on the basis of that, you cultivate, on the basis of being self-aware and living from your own side, genuinely, you cultivate emotional positivity. What really flourishes us is when we, what growth is a growth in positivity, which is a growth in largeness of heart, in ampleness of mind. You could just define emotional positivity better in that way, a largeness of heart and an ampleness of mind. So you're able to think deeply, feel strongly, be generous, outgoing, courageous, not timid, not neurotic, and so on. Even those things are an ideal enough. And then as far as spiritual life goes, Dharma life goes, you then try to see that actually however positive you are, that's never enough. Self always gets in the way. However refined you get, however developed you become, self is always a little bit ugly. And without moving on to the next stage, our positivity easily gets a bit calcified. I've seen this sometimes with very cultured people. A lot of people could do with being much more cultured. But I have also met very cultured people who end up being sort of rather calcified. They sort of get stuck in eating fine foods, drinking fine wines, being able to quote passages of Shakespeare. But it's rather lifeless. It's rather etiolated. It's rather sort of thin. It's like it's all dried up a bit. So positive emotion isn't enough. To really live out our potential, we need to sort of die. We need to die to ourselves. We need to see through self-clinging. And this is a stage of spiritual death. We need to see that this me that we're trying to develop is just a fiction. It's a construction and one that's getting in the way. And then when we die to ourselves, when we see through our self-clinging, as it's put, we become a wholly new species. We become effectively a Buddha. This image is an image for what arises quite naturally and without effort when we see through the delusion of self. When we see that self is just a story that we've got stuck in. When we see that we're just living in a story, and how much our life conforms to our story kind of shows that. It's very striking, isn't it, sometimes when you meet people and you know them, you can see how strongly their story is creating their experience. So what they think is their experience is really their story. And our stories confirm ourselves. Very, very, well, sort of seems to be easy to see in others. Very, very difficult to see in yourself. There's something about human beings that can see each other's stories and even be quite canny about that, but are strangely blind about ourselves. We're like kittens, we're born blind. We can't sort of see ourselves very easily. Incidentally, this is one of the reasons why friendship's so important. You need people around you who can say, but that's just your story. You see how that's created suffering for you. I don't know whether you've ever, I don't know, gone away somewhere for the weekend and you realise once you're there that you really don't want to be there. And all you need to do to have a really pleasant weekend is dwell on the fact that you don't want to be there, because you are there, you know. But that story of I don't want to be there creates the pain that tells you you don't want to be there, do you know what I mean? If you say, I wish I wasn't here, like if you're thinking, I wish I hadn't come tonight, what that will do, it'll make you suffer, which is exactly why you think you wish you hadn't been here tonight, if you see me. We literally create our life with the story of being me. And friends at best can help us see ourselves, see our stories a bit more clearly, if they're brave enough. But when we see through that story, right the way through to the core, and the core of that story is innate, it's what brings us into this life. What arises is something like this. This kind of glory, this kind of majesty. They're always gold, which represents something beyond the ordinary, beyond day-to-day consciousness. And Bhante Sangha actually calls that spiritual rebirth. So in a way, that's the sort of vision of human life. That first of all, we need to become truly grown up and integrated. On the basis of that, we flourish in positive emotion. Another really simple way of saying that is that we, everywhere we go, we make a contribution. Instead of taking from a situation, we give to it. Everywhere we go, whether it's whether it's standing in the queue at Tesco's, or leading a Buddhist class, or meeting our parents, or being with friends, everywhere we go, we just keep making a contribution of some kind. We can actually do that. It is quite within our grasp. And then on the basis of that contribution, we start to see that actually I just want to be that contribution. That this coming back to me all the time and say, because so often we make a contribution, don't we? And think, oh, that was really good. I'm like a really nice guy. As soon as we think I'm like a really nice guy, we're suddenly not such a nice guy. It doesn't mean. Or as soon as we think I did that really well, I was like really kind. As soon as we do that, we're not so kind, you know what I mean? So you start to see, just out of that positivity, that this frustrating return back to me is actually undermining that positivity. And so you see it has to die. And then when that dies, in spiritual death, this is what arises. This mystery of the Buddha is what arises. In a way, sometimes I'd like it not to have a fig at all, just to have a lit throne in which we can imagine a mystery. Sometimes the image of the Buddha gets too stale. But within that is this question of receptivity, spiritual receptivity, so it doesn't immediately fit into that schema. So you can put it in two places, either at the end or between each stage. So I want to... look how time's gone. I want to just say something about those two things. So you could think, therefore, in terms of a journey, which I've already described, or you could think of a mandala. So as a journey, you need integration first, and on the basis of that, positive emotion, and so on. Or you say, hey, it's not quite like that. Let's just think of it as a mandala, a pattern, in which all of those things are present all the time. And what Dharma life is not a journey from A to Z, but the unfolding of a flower, the unfolding of more and more integration, the unfolding of more and more positive emotion, the unfolding of more and more spiritual depth. And both of these metaphors, one of them is spatial, one of them is temporal, get at what Dharma life is really about. You can think of it as a journey, and there are problems in that metaphor, and you can then think of it as the unfolding of a flower, and there's problems in that metaphor. In a way, both metaphors correct each other. Amen? both metaphors correct each other. So, as a mandala, as a kind of unfolding flower, the mandala is supposed to be the design for for a basis of a temple, but I think it's more like an open flower with the stamen in the middle. As a mandala, you're always trying to cultivate all of those things all the time. Integration, positive emotion, spiritual death, and spiritual rebirth. And you're trying to create receptivity, spiritual receptivity, dharmic receptivity. If you were to then put that as a journey, you'd have to say between each stage is receptivity. And you'd want that to be the rhythm of the journey. Activity, quiet, activity, quiet, activity, receptivity, all the time. Yeah. When Sangharakshapa first started teaching meditation, he would always teach, he'd do the mindfulness of breathing, just sitting, metta bhavana, just sitting. And then next section, mindfulness, just sitting, metta bhavana, just sitting. His vision of meditation was that every meditation was sort of punctuated by just sitting. In other words, non-cultivation, just being, just stopping. Yeah? So this becomes a central principle in spiritual life, that there is activity and then there's just stopping. Then there's activity and just stopping. Yeah? So what we're going to be emphasising in this seminar is this aspect of activity and then just stopping. We're going to be exploring the different dimensions of receptivity. So that's receptivity as part of the mandala. We need to become more emotionally positive at the same time as being that and more integrated in spiritual death and so on. We need to be just more. We need to open up more. Just be receptive more. In other words, do nothing more. And not try to cultivate anything more. Just at the same time as doing all these other aspects of the mandala, we need an aspect of pure uselessness, of non-utility, of just doing nothing, of not trying to go anywhere, not trying to achieve anything. And that needs to be woven through the texture of our spiritual life, our human life, our Dharma life. But then if you were to then go back to the journey, receptivity would go at the end, and at the end of the journey it changes its nature into being spontaneous, compassionate activity. The two things are the same. So the practice, a sort of central practice, if you think of receptivity having a practice, which is also rather problematic, I think, because receptivity is a non-practice, and I want to resist any temptation to make it into a practice, because as soon as the practice is something you do, if you see me, and that's the whole point. You're not doing anything. But if you had to think of it very metaphorically as a practice, the practice that you do is just sitting, obviously. Just as mindfulness of breathing is the practice related to integration, metta bhavana is a practice related to emotional positivity, the six element practice is the practice associated with spiritual death, and so on. So you just sit. And in just sitting, you're just sitting. You're not trying to do anything. You're not trying to be anyone. You're not trying to cultivate anything. You're just sitting. So do you see how, if you were to put that anywhere on the path of the journey, then you put it right at the end. Because when the Buddha gained enlightenment, in a sense, all there was for him was receptivity. There wasn't anyone there to do anything. There was no sense of the Buddha that there was anything to do. It's sometimes also called this last stage, the stage of no more learning. Sometimes called the stage of spontaneous compassionate activity, sometimes called the stage of no more learning. So the Buddha isn't compassionate, he isn't wise, he's in a way just sitting, or just talking to you, or just walking, or just being. He's not trying to do anything at all. He's actually seen through the idea that there's a self to try to do anything anyway. So in this sense, spiritual receptivity is the goal of spiritual life, where you are just sitting, you are just being. And at its depth, if we were to go through the whole path, that just being would be perceived by other people as a perfection of compassion and wisdom. But you wouldn't be being wise or be being compassionate. You'd just be being yourself. You know what I mean? So spiritual receptivity at the end of the spiritual life becomes a stage of no more learning. It becomes a stage of compassion, spontaneous compassionate activity. Your way of being yourself as a Buddha is to be spontaneously compassionate. So in this seminar, mostly we'll be focusing on receptivity as an aspect of the mandala of practice, as something we need to cultivate alongside integration, positive emotion and so forth, every day. I mean, the great thing about these five stages is all you need to do is make sure you've got something in your life every day that does those five stages. Something that cultivates integration, something that cultivates positive emotion, something that cultivates spiritual death, and that can be something like apology or confession and so on. Something that cultivates spiritual rebirth, which is your imagination, puja and so on. Something that cultivates receptivity, doing nothing, for instance. Yeah. All you need to do is those five things every day, and Bob's your uncle, you'll make progress. Yeah, simple. Five things, that's all you need, five things. So in this seminar we'll be mainly emphasising spiritual receptivity, and we'll be mainly emphasising it as an aspect of your day-to-day practice. So we're going to look at spiritual receptivity in terms of Vedana, especially Vedana in the body. Yeah? This feeling sensation in the body, being receptive to that, both as a practice, as it were, and as an aspect of enlightenment. Then we're going to look at spiritual receptivity in terms of the natural world and the arts, being receptive to nature and art. Then we're going to look at spiritual receptivity, being receptive to others. And all of these, we're going to also want to talk about the insight element of that. So receptive to others. Then we're going to look at spiritual receptivity in terms of receptive to those who have made more spiritual progress, people who are called Kayana Mitras, auspicious friends, people who have practiced a path for longer than we have, exemplified by the Buddha. Eventually, the Buddha is called the Kalyana Mitra of the world, the friend of the world. So we want to look at receptivity in that aspect, both in its practical application and in its insight element. And then we'll conclude 6 weeks by spending 2 weeks of looking at receptivity to the nature of things, to how things really are, being open to reality itself. Yeah. So that's what we're going to be doing on the seminar. Okay, so what I'd like to do now is finish the evening by, we'll just do a short puja, and then we're going to finish with the Padmasambhava mantra, which I'll somehow manage to lead both parts. So I'll lead one part, and then those of you who want to join in with that part can join in. And then I'll lead another part, and those of you who know that other part can join into that. Yeah. And what I'd like to do is suggest we all, well, not all of us, perhaps shuffle backwards a bit so we can make a bit more space around the shrine.